My name is Richard Lamparski, and my guest today, I hope, feels at home. She's been here once before, and then another time we met when we took a big group photograph at the after offices. When Mary Jane Higby was here, I think about a year ago, we were doing When a Girl Marries.
Oh, isn't that it? Long now.
With Louis Van Ruten, and he came on to plug a delightful book, which was sort of nursery rhyme in French.
Mot de goose rhyme,
We'll be plugging another book today. As a matter of fact, didn't you change the title of your book, Miss Higby?
Yes, it is now called Tune In Tomorrow.
Yeah, and before, now let's see if my memory is right. It was called The Show Must Go On and On and On.
That's
is that right?
Yes.
That's pretty good for a year, isn't it?
Well, that title is still in the book. It's as a chapter heading. It seemed better not to duplicate that. And Tune In Tomorrow, I think, catches the idea very quickly to the reader. My own choice of up your antenna, nobody would accept.
Now, that's one I'd have run out and bought a copy.
I think so. I think that we missed a big bet there. We had a lot of people that would have liked that title.
Sure, I think that's right for this day and age. It could have gone over very well. Anyway, the book is called Tune In Tomorrow. And I've got a surprise for you. I've read it.
Oh, great.
Is that a surprise, or have you done many of the radio and TV shows yet?
No, it's interesting. I think the more important the show, the more certain you are that someone in the studio will have done the homework. This is my observation. It's very often in some small area, people don't bother. But usually when you get on the top shows, you find that they want to know what you're going to talk about.
Well, I have no Jeannie Bock, so I read it myself. But it's a delightful book. In my introduction of Mary Jane Higby, I didn't say that she was on When a Girl Marries for, I think, 18 years, right? How long were you Nora Drake?
Oh, that was only about 18 months. I was the last Nora Drake, just before all of radio, as we knew it in those days, the great days of the daytime serials and the big comedians at night and the variety shows and all that. When that went off, which the final daytime serial, I think, went off about 59.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I was doing Nora Drake.
Well, today you'll have to be Nora Drake. We'll call this Whatever Became of Nora Drake.
All right.
I don't have I have a surprise for you, as I told you when you came in today. I don't have any music from Nora Drake, but I've got an album that was just put out by Nostalgia Records, which is part of the Nostalgia Book Club, which has bought my book, by the way. Maybe they'll
wonderful.
Buy yours.
Congratulations.
They buy most of these, the better books, I think, on Nostalgia. They had one called, isn't that funny? I can't think of it now, but it was a very well-done book about a year ago that came out, and they bought both of mine, so I recommend yours to them. Anyway, it's published by the Nostalgia Book Club, which is in New Rochelle. It's called Radio Yesteryear Presents... like old times, 90, count 'em, genuine original curtain raisers. These are the actual recordings of the beginnings of radio shows.
When they say curtain raisers, they mean the little lead-in that we
have? Yeah, which are really the most fun, I think. So I've got five or six here, and we'll play them during this program. Let's begin now with...
fun to hear those again.
Yeah, let's begin now with Tom Mix.
Come on, boy! Start the day all shining bright. Gives you lots of cowboy energy with a flavor that's just right. It's delicious and nutritious, right size and ready to eat. Take a tip from Tom, go and tell your mom, shredded Ralston can't be beat.
The Tom Mix Ralston Straight Shooters bring you action, mystery, and mile-a-minute thrills in radio's biggest Western detective program. Tonight you're about to hear another episode in a baffling mystery, Secret Mission.
Does that take you back?
A long way. In the old silent days, my father used to do a lot of Tom Mix films. My father was an actor.
With the real Tom.
With the real Tom Mix.
Yeah, because I don't think Tom Mix was really on the program,
was
he?
No. No, I think before the program went on, maybe Tom had died.
They used real bullets.
I remember him very well when I was a child. Wonderful man.
Tell me a bit about him, because he's not in your book. So tell me some stories that are not in your book, because we'll tell about the book. I don't want to give it all away.
Well, my father went to Hollywood when I was a very small child, and I decided to go with him. And my mother did, too. I mean, it was a family affair. We all moved. And They found out that not only was he a New York actor, but they quickly found out that he was a Michigan farm boy. And they said, well, will you be able to ride with a Western saddle? And he said, who needs a saddle? My father did. Because he'd been brought up just bringing the horses in, you know, bareback. And then he was very big in Westerns for a while. And the big star, of course, was Tom Mix. Tom Mix was no shrinking violet. And there was a restaurant on Hollywood Boulevard. Hollywood was a tiny village in these days, but it was called the Blue Front Cafe, I think, by the fan magazines, but the actual name of it was Armstrong Carlton. It may still be there. And it had a big window, and most of the film stars, when they went in, would retreat to the back of the restaurant so they couldn't, well, they could be seen if you came in, but not from the street. But dear Mr. Mix liked that front window, and my father was a retiring soul, and I used to come home from school, and many's the time I saw my shrinking, blushing father eating his lunch with Tom Mix with an enormous group of staring fans standing around the window, just staring in, watching the actors eat. That's what they were doing.
And it didn't bother Mr. Mix at all.
Oh, he loved it. He was smiling. I remember one day, that's why I took the table. I went up and tapped on the window, and my father was absolutely cringing, you see. And Tom Mix had to push him and say, look out there, there's your daughter. I was about seven or eight.
Did he always dress in that glamorized Western garb? All the pictures I've ever seen of him, he had.
Well, I think that I suppose when he got home, he relaxed a little. But I never saw him in anything else. I'm sure he didn't wear it all the time, but in his public appearances, he did. His daughter was a great rider, too. You know, she was with the circus for years.
His wife, I understand, is still living in Hollywood.
So?
Yeah, because someone told me she controlled the Tom Mix films, which I've never seen on TV, and that, they said, was the reason that it had never been on. I didn't talk about how many wonderful pictures Miss Higbee has in her book. Gee, there's some marvelous things in here. Ed Wynn with Orson Welles, with Charlie McCarthy, with Edgar Bergen. Edgar Bergen is in my book, by the way. And Fred Allen with Mrs. Nussbaum. Minerva Pius is in my book.
And Senator Claghorn. That's Minerva Pius and
right?
Kenny Delmar.
Yeah. Minerva Pius, as you probably know, lives right here in New York.
I was talking to her on the phone. Kenny does, too. All of these people are close friends, of course. We worked together for many years on all the different shows, and they contributed a great deal to the material in my book. Kenny gave me a great many anecdotes.
Yeah, there's some really charming stories in here. Here's another one who's also in my book, Rubinoff, the violinist.
Yes, Rubinoff, I don't know.
Well, I don't know him.
He was a big thing in radio.
Yeah,
he was great. I think I worked on shows where Rubinoff was playing, but we had no contact.
Luella Parsons with Mary Pickford. Preparing Luella's Hollywood Hotel. Gee, I remember that so well. That was 1935, but it ran longer than that because I remember it late into the 30s.
The picture is from 1935.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It did. It lasted 6 years, I think, in all. It was an enormous success. It was one of the most successful radio shows that ever existed. I have a full-page picture of Hollywood Hotel there with the entire cast and the orchestra.
Why was it that Miss Parsons didn't go on Parties at Pickfair, the Mary Pickford program?
Well, that was a long Hollywood feud, which ended for a while with the Hearst papers suspending all mention of radio and cutting their radio columns. It was quickly, to make it as quick as I can, it's quite a long story. Miss Parsons was the only person who was able to get all of these glamorous and terribly important movie stars to appear for nothing on her radio program. And, of course, they did it because she was the newspaper columnist with the greatest force in the whole theatrical field, the greatest power. And if she asked them, it was a command appearance. Well, someone got the idea that Mary Pickford was well-loved, which was true, and that she could achieve the same thing. So I suppose what happened was that Mary Pickford called several of her friends, and they all said they'd love to do it. But the program really was not quite a duplication of Hollywood Hotel. It was called Parties at Pickfair, but it nudged up very close to it. And the first thing we knew, I was on the Parties at Pickfair broadcast, the first thing we knew, one by one, the stars started canceling their appearances on the Pickford show. They never did get on the air. So they just refused to come.
The show never did get on the air?
The show got on the air, but it got on with a group of radio actors after it had been highly publicized. And with Edward Everett Horton, who was afraid of no one on earth, No one could bluff Eddie Horton out of anything he wanted to do.
And he works every day of his life, so.
And always has, yes. I think, since he was three. And he was paid a nice big fee because he wasn't the least bit interested in doing anything for nothing for anybody. And he's a charming, wonderful man. Gave me my first chance on network radio. I shall never forget it. And so they had him, and then they found a boy soprano. At the last minute, they were just dashing around. The producers were trying to gather up bits and pieces to put the show on the air. And ultimately, they got it on in a sort of half-baked way. And it struggled on through about almost a year, I think. But they were never able to get all those glamorous stars for nothing. They had to pay everyone who appeared on the show. And that was the influence that Luella Parsons had in those days. And returning to her show, this is not in the book. It was the first occasion when Richard Dick Powell ever played a dramatic role. He was only an MC and a band singer. And he was on that show, and they had a very versatile and clever director named Bacher. And Bacher convinced him that he could play the lead in The Student Prince, and he demurred. He didn't want to do it. And Bacher talked him into it. And then after that, bit by bit, he began to expand within the radio show, playing different parts, and got confidence, and then made some films where he had spoken lines. And as you know, at the end of his life, he had his own television show.
Yes, indeed.
As an actor. He became very important as an actor. And I think that's interesting about the growth of a person like that from a radio situation.
Yes, very, because he had a very varied career by the time he died. I mean, Dick Powell had done just, he had produced, he had directed, he'd done some very good dramatic work, and the earlier part of his career, actually, I think, is probably the lesser of it, you know, the singing and dancing. It's kind of funny now, but he turned it out to be a very good actor. You've been working on this book for a long time, because this show has been on the air since March of 65, and one of the first guests I had was Vivian Smolin.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was recording her, it was at her apartment house, and she said, we might have a guest appearance by Nora Drake, because she was supposed to, Mary Jane Higby was supposed to drop in and see me this afternoon, but for some reason you were delayed, and
yes, we
didn't
make
but,
it that time.
But she told me then you were working on the book.
Yes, well, I did enormous research. I'm sure you
it's
know
very
that
obvious
the thing is,
in the
is
book.
Autobiographical,
yes.
But I spent so much time in the public library checking my memory and checking the memory of my friends, trying to sift fiction from fact, because as I said in there, you know, actors are an imaginative lot, and sometimes the story that began, oh, wouldn't it be funny if... finally became, you know, I was there when, you see, and I had to sift all that out and get down to the facts. And I learned a lot of things I hadn't known about the field from the research I did. I read Variety, the trade paper, you know, our theatrical trade paper, from 1932 through 1958 on microfilm. I didn't read all of the paper, but I read the radio and television page.
Well, one aspect of the book which I liked very much as a reviewer, I don't know if it would impress the average reader, is that you give dates, certainly a year of dates, which always confuses me in biographies or autobiographies. They'll say then. Well, then is when? During the 30s? That could be 32. It could be 39.
They do it because it's very difficult. I never kept a diary. And I was calling people and saying, when did we work with Emily Post? And people would not even remember what shows they themselves had done. You know, you and I have two friends, Buxton and Owen, Bill Owen and Frank Buxton. And they wrote that wonderful book on a radio.
Radio's Golden Years.
That's right. And they said that they noticed it right away. I think I was the first person they called. And not the first person they called, but the first one who gave this answer. They said... tell us something about John's other wife. And I said, well, that's the only thing I really can't help you because I was never on it. And they said, oh, Mary Jane, we're looking at the cast list. You were in the original cast. You were on the first broadcast. You and Hanley Stafford. And I said, oh, was I? I have no recollection of it because we did so many thousands of radio programs, all of us, who were working actively in the field. And then later they said they talked to Elspeth Eric. And she said the same thing. She used to be Joyce Jordan girl intern. They'd ask her about a program, and she'd say, oh, I don't remember it. I don't think I was ever on it. And they'd say, well, we're looking at the original cast list, and there you are. It was easy to forget the content of the shows and even identify them unless something disastrous happened. That's usually what I remembered, and that's what went in the book. The out-and-out disasters are campy things.
Well, I know that I called an actor about a year ago. I won't mention his name. And I wanted him to do a program because he was the he had the title role, one of the best remembered of the radio shows. And he said, well, why would you ask me? And I said, well, I thought you would reminisce, and then we would have your assistant on with you. I've already talked with him, and he's willing. He said, well, I was never on that program. And I said, well, you were the lead. He said, oh, no, I don't think so. So he said, just a moment, and he evidently asked his wife. She said, oh, yes, you were the lead for a year or so. Now, I find this incredible that he wouldn't remember.
I know.
He came back and said, I guess I was, but I just don't remember all those things.
There is one possible explanation. You know, the most frequent disease given to soap opera characters was amnesia.
That's right.
You know, they used to wake. My leading man woke, I think, in 1954 and said, where am I? And there's a very interesting story in connection with that. The first hero to be struck with amnesia was Joe of Mary Marlin. You remember Ann Seymour was the star of that, and had, with that exquisite voice. She's a big television personality now. And she used to say, I am Mary Marlin, at the beginning of the show. And one day, her leading man woke on the story, of course, saying, where am I? What town is this? And the next time they took a rating to find out how many people were listening, Mary Marlin was miles ahead of every other show on the air. So within 2 weeks, every leading man on every daytime serial was saying, where am I? What town is this? But when they took the next rating, they found that the whole thing had leveled out pretty well. Mary was still leading, but she was only leading by a nose. And it wasn't for really many, many months that they discovered there'd been an enormous mistake made in taking the rating, that they had forgotten to include the number of stations. And in some way, this threw all the figures out. And in that false rating, where the rest of them had had perhaps a 4, Mary had come sailing in with a 7 or something like that. And actually, when other people had a 4, she had a 4.2, you see. She was leading. And that lesson seemed never to have been to really impress the writers. And whenever they felt the ratings sag, it seemed to me that they used to inject amnesia into the plot. So my point, as a result of that great Mary Marlin surge, which never really took place, and I have a feeling that perhaps we all suffered a little from just talking about amnesia that much. Perhaps we hypnotized ourselves into a state of mental atrophy.
Well, the movies did it too, though, didn't they? They were always using amnesia as a plot.
Oh, did they?
Oh, yes.
I can't think of many of those.
Oh, well, I think Random Harvest is one.
Oh, of course, and that's wonderful.
Comes right off, yeah.
Oh, I've never... Wasn't that Ronald Coleman?
Yes.
And that magnificent scene of recognition was played so subtly, so delicately.
Uh-huh. Listen, I've got an LCBB opening, too.
So oh, great. Let's hear it.
Let's hear
Do
that.
Do they know what LCBB is?
Why don't you tell them? We've done a show on it, but tell them, LCBB.
We all used to... we did so many shows, we had to keep books to glance at every now and then during the day to see where we belonged next, which network was requiring our services at that moment and what show. And, of course, there wasn't room in a small book to write out all these tremendously long names. And a show called Life Can Be Beautiful was frequently initialed, you see, just the initials were given. And... gradually, it began to be known to the trade, to the kids within the area, within the working area, as LCBB.
So here's how it began.
John Ruskin wrote this: whenever money is the principal object of life, it is both got ill and spent ill, and does harm both in getting and spending. When getting and spending happiness is our aim, life can be beautiful. Life Can Be Beautiful is an inspiring message of faith drawn from life, written by Carl Bixby and Don Becker, and brought to you by Spick and Span. No soap, no other cleaner. Nothing in America cleans painted walls, woodwork, and linoleum like Spick and Span.
My guest today is Miss Mary Jane Higbee, who is the author of a new book published by Kohl's, and it's called Tune In Tomorrow. It's a wonderfully nostalgic book and very informative book about the golden years of radio, which we discuss so very often on this program. I wonder if you will. I do want you to do one story from the book, because it's such a cute story, about the Barretts of Wimpole Street, when Lux Present Hollywood did the Barretts of Wimpole Street, and they had the man on who was famous for doing the dog, sound of the dog growling and barking. Will you tell that story?
Yes, I'd love to. You've made a little mistake, but I know that you just read the book recently, but... It wasn't Lux. It was the Theater Guild of the Air, and I can't tell you how terribly impressive that show was, because they had only the top Broadway stage stars.
Most prestigious show in the air.
It was, absolutely, and it was produced with great care. They went into the lighting as though they were doing the ballet. And usually radio programs were produced a little more informally than that. Now, we had two magnificent animal imitators in New York radio. I have never heard their like, and I doubt if I ever will again. And one of them was named Brad Barker. The other one was Donald Bain, and this story concerns Donald Bain, who was a small, chubby man with a hayseed personality. I don't think even he himself would object to that description. And he used to go shuffling around the halls and the networks absentmindedly, cooing and clucking to himself. He specialized in bird noises and small animals, whereas Brad Barker did the larger animals. It's Brad's voice that you hear when that lion roars at the beginning of every MGM film. And Brad was also the Pathé rooster on the Pathé newsreel. So you can identify that right away. They were both perfect, as I say. Well, now, Donald was playing Flush in the production of The Barretts of Wimpole Street, which, on the air, starred Madeline Carroll and Charles Waldron, who had been the original on the Broadway in the Broadway production, and Brian Ahern, who, too, had played in the original production. And he was playing the little dog, and he came out. They all dressed for the show, of course. She in a gorgeous evening gown, never looked more beautiful in her life under this beautiful spotlight. And the men in beautiful dinner jackets, the announcer, everyone in dinner jackets. And Donald, too, in his little dinner jacket, and he came shuffling out. And when the time came, he barked and he snarled and he did a lot of things that little dogs do. He thought he was very inventive, and he snuffled and he sniffed. And you really could see the little animal. It was a magnificent performance. Perhaps it was a little strong because he had an audience and he liked to play before an audience. And when he finished, there was a little murmur in the audience because a man had done all this, and they had a large theater engaged with an enormous studio audience. And the studio audience, this little murmur ran through it, and Donald heard it, and he whipped around and made a low, sweeping bow to the audience. Well, of course, it was right in the middle of the scene, and the audience just broke up. It was a very funny effect to see this little man go, arf, ruff, 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 and then turn around and take a deep bow for his efforts. Well, after that, whenever he even appeared on the stage to do his little part of Flush, there was a big laugh from the audience. And, of course, the Theater Guild producers were dismayed. It rather destroyed the effect that went out over the air. And they didn't use him for a long time, but one day they needed a wild duck. I guess they were doing an Ibsen drama. And they had to have him because he was the great wild duck specialist. And when he came, he found that he had been located behind sound effects with a microphone about 2 feet above the ground. So he had to stoop down and hide behind the counter of sound effects in order to make the sound. And he was saying, I don't see why they discriminate against me this way. Why, I got the biggest hand they ever had on this show. He was a wonderful man, a great eccentric.
That's one of the many charming stories that are in Tune In Tomorrow. Let's listen to the opening of, as long as I mention, Lux Radio Theater. I think it had one of the most impressive openings on
marvelous.
The air.
Marvelous. Oh, I'd be glad to hear it myself.
Okay, let's hear Lux Radio Theater.
Lux presents Hollywood. Lux Radio Theater brings you Rita Hayworth and Charles Corbin in This Love of Ours. Ladies and gentlemen, your producer, Mr. William Keeley.
I've got another one for you, which is not, isn't as impressive, but I always say this every time I mention the show. Vic and Sade is the most popular show among old radio fans. I get more mail about it. I get more inquiries about Vic and Sade than all the movie stars and radio and TV people.
Have you heard a Vic and Sade show?
Oh, of course.
In late years?
Oh, in late years.
They are great.
Oh, yes. They're wonderful.
They are just
great.
They
were before their time.
Well, they were popular. They were wildly
successful,
you know. It was an enormous thing. And, it was caught on with the public immediately.
get ready to smile again with radio's home folks, Vacant Sade, written by Paul Reimer.
Oddly enough, it went on my birthday. I found that when I was doing research, I discovered that.
What year was that?
1932. It was the year Vic and Sade went on the air. It's the year I went on the air, and other things that were more important. Fred Allen's first year. It was the year that the great Rudy Valley show was created. Rudy Valley had been on the air for quite a while, but he changed his format that year and became what we later knew as the Fleischman Hour with Rudy Valley, which was a great variety show. And then the others really copied the Valley show, I think. Most of the big... He set the pattern for it. That's what I'm trying to say.
I've got a couple more that I want to get in before the program ends.
Right.
We better do one right now, which is one of my favorite spooky programs, Lights Out.
Mm-hmm.
I understand Raymond Johnson's living in Vermont. Did you talk with him?
I haven't seen Ray for a long, long time. I'd love to see him.
He's been very ill. Raymond, the famous Raymond.
That's right, with the squeaky door.
What a great voice. Mm-hmm.
This is the witching hour. It is the hour when dogs howl and evil is let loose on a sleeping world. Want to hear about it? Then turn out your lights.
You worked a lot of shows.
Oh, yes. He was on When a Girl Marries with me, and we did so many shows together. We couldn't begin to count them. We couldn't tell you. That's the old amnesia thing.
I had a letter from him a couple of years ago, and he was living, I think it was in Vermont, with his wife. He said he'd been ill, and he didn't come to New York. And he wished me well and said he had heard of the program and to say hello to all of his actors. He has a very good reputation in the business, you know, among actors, evidently being a very nice man.
I wish I could have talked to Ray because he was one of the funniest men that ever lived. And I know he would have had anecdotes that would have been very, very helpful to me.
Let me ask you just briefly. When you went out to the coast to do the show from the coast for a while, was there a big difference in working on the coast? Because there is for movies.
No. There was a big difference, but it had nothing to do with being on the coast. It was when tape had first come in, and we were allowed to tape the shows. What is usually forgotten about radio in the 30s and 40s is that every word, every sound heard on the networks was live. They would permit no recording. In the early days, even sound effects could not be recorded.
No commercials.
Oh, no. That was why commercials were such a horror.
Sure. Singing commercials were done live.
Oh, I did a lot of singing commercials, and that was a traumatic experience.
Let's do one more opening. This is from a program that I've already had one of the men on who was on it, One Man's Family.
This is One Man's Family. One Man's Family is dedicated to the mothers and fathers of the younger generation and to their bewildering offspring. Today, transcribed, we present Chapter 12, Book 72, entitled A Touch of Christmas Spirit.
I want to suggest to the audience they make it a nostalgic Christmas or Hanukkah and give a copy of Tune In Tomorrow. I think it's a delightful gift book. For Christmas.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. And if they want to, they can even buy a copy of Whatever Became of Series 2.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, they can do that through the station. I have to do a hard sell commercial now because WBAI is selling the books. And if anyone would like a copy autographed any way they want it, you know, Happy Hanukkah or anything, or Merry Christmas, if they write to the station, which is WBAI, and send $5.25, and the address is 30 East 39th Street, New York, 10016. And I'd like it very much if they bought the book through the station, because in that way the station gets all the profits. And since we never annoy you with commercials, it would be rather a nice
thing to do. What is the title of the book I'm to send for?
Oh, they all know. It's called Whatever Became. You get a free one.
Whatever Became of?
Whatever Became of. Oh. Series 2. It's the new one. I think most of the listeners are familiar with the old one. I've been plugging it for 2 years now.
Did you tell them what became of Miss Duffy of Duffy's Tavern?
Oh, I think they all know. She's Shirley Booth.
She's Hazel.
Yes,
I was
Hazel.
She's
but Hazel, I think, is off the air now, isn't it?
Yes, I just said
so
that.
So many of those people you worked with, or the picture you have in your book of Richard Widmark, you know, who became a big star. And,
yes.
And
Van Heflin and Tony Randall and Art Carney and Agnes Moorhead. They were all radio actors in depth.
It's funny.
I mean, they were earning their living that way.
Yeah, I did a program on gangbusters about a year ago, and they said how often Art Carney had been on. Evidently, he was a regular on Gangbusters. And both of the actors here said, you know, it's funny because we never thought Art would go anywhere. We thought he had enormous talent, but he had no drive at all. He had no direction.
He's a very modest, retiring, lovely person.
They said he used to sit down at rehearsals and play on the piano and sing ridiculous little songs that he would make up. And they always say, gee, he's clever. It's too bad. He just... he'll never click because he just has no drive at all.
Well, that amount of talent, I guess, and the exposure you see that Gleason gave him, you don't need drive because the talent does it for you. You know, the Bible says, a man's gift maketh room for him. And I think that proved itself to be true in Art Carney's and also in Tony Randall's case. We all knew that Tony was a great light comedian, but it never occurred to any of us that everyone would know it so quickly.
Was your husband on any of the programs you did?
Oh, yes. My husband...
Guy Sorrell, by the way.
Yes, Guy Sorrell. He likes us to call him Guy. I call him Guy because that's what his mother called him.
An awful lot of people in the business do call him Guy, though.
I know they do. It's my silly fault. It's very confusing to the public, you know, because it's a French pronunciation. But his family is a French background. But he did a radio program that was really one of the most beautiful that was ever on the air called You Are There. And he was the only member of the permanent cast.
They tried that on television.
Yes.
And I don't think it really clicked like it did on the air.
Oh, it was so wonderful on the air. It was a recreation of historical situations. As a matter of fact, I think there's a record of that available that was made years ago.
Yes, there is. I don't know if it's still out, but there was one.
And he's on it, of course.
Very imaginative show. I remember they did one, the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, and you could hear the ashes falling on the CBS sound truck. You know, the sound truck
wonderful.
Was there, and you could hear it.
It's a fabulous idea.
Yeah, very, very exciting. And my guest today has been Miss Mary Jane Higbee, who, along with being a radio actor of some note for a number of years, she was Nora Drake and the star of One of Gerald Mary's, is the author of a brand-new book called Tune In Tomorrow. It's published by Kohl's. And I'll mention the price. Most people don't, but it's $5.95. It's a dollar more than mine. But it's full of pictures, and it has a lot of information and dates, and I recommend it highly. And thanks very much, Mary Jane Higbee.
Well, this has been a very pleasant experience, as it was last time.
Good. You'll have to come back again. Next time you write a book.
Love to. Oh, that'll be another day. That'll be a long day off.
Thanks very much to you for listening. Until next week at the same time, this is Richard Lamparsky. Good night.
And his gypsy violins. It's time to announce that this is WBAI in New York and that the preceding was recorded.